I did what I did. It's all on the public record. And I feel very good about it. If I had to do it over again, I'd do it in a minute.
I often wonder how much better a reputation the Bush administration would have had if Dick Cheney hadn't been there. Perhaps George W. has thought the same thing at one point. In hindsight, having such an experienced player on your team should be great. But what happens when they begin to outmaneuver you? Dick Cheney may have just passed away, but his legacy will live on. He will be remembered for being the most controversial and polarizing vice president this nation has ever had. With the exception of Aaron Burr, of course. And neither man could manage the office without shooting someone. But only Dick Cheney could get the guy to apologize to him. From getting kicked out of Yale twice, to two DUIs, to being the youngest chief of staff, and then finally the vice president, Dick Cheney had a wild ride to the top. What made him one of the most hated modern politicians of all time? Well, I'll answer that among many other things on this episode. I'm your host, Rachel Payton, and you're listening to the Chronicles of Time. Let's dive into the life of Dick Cheney. Richard Bruce Cheney was born in 1941 in Lincoln, Nebraska. He was raised in Casper, Wyoming, after his father accepted work there. The vast land and outdoor life that Wyoming brought would make quite the impression on the young Dick and stay with him for a lifetime. By the eighth grade, he had met his future wife, Lynn. The pair began going steady in high school and would remain together his entire life. In school, Dick played football and was senior class president. He managed to get into Yale somehow, but flunked out his freshman year due to his drinking and feeling inferior to his classmates. He somehow gets back into Yale, but now without his scholarship, and he gets flunked out once again, his sophomore year. At this point, the year is 1962, and Cheney is working as a lineman for $3.10 an hour. He gets arrested for a DUI in November, and not even a year later is arrested for another. Lynn, beyond disappointed in him, gives Dick a new one. The exact conversation is unknown, but what we do know is that it made Cheney turn his life around. Dick decided to attend the University of Wyoming, and I suppose Lynn saw a better man, one to be proud of, because the couple would marry in August of 1964. In 66, he graduated with his master's in political science. Then he was accepted into a doctoral program at the University of Wisconsin. He would never complete the program, instead going to work for a congressman. This choice would ultimately change the trajectory of his entire life. He was only 27 when he moved to Washington, D.C. in 1968. While working his congressional fellowship, he lands an interview with Donald Rumsfeld, who was a member of the House of Representatives. According to both men, the entire half-hour interview was terrible. Cheney found Rumsfeld arrogant, where Rumsfeld found Cheney too academically oriented. The next year, Rumsfeld was appointed by President Richard Nixon to head the OEO, the Office of Economic Opportunity. He receives this unsolicited 12-page memo giving him advice from, lo and behold, Dick Cheney. Oddly enough, Rumsfeld enjoyed the memo. He remembered Cheney from that disastrous interview, but yet still offers him a job. Not even 30 years old, and Dick Cheney was working for the Nixon administration. During his time, he served in the OEO, the Cost of Living Council, and on the White House staff. In 1974, when the Watergate scandal, which I cover in episode 2 and 3 of the show, engulfed Richard Nixon's presidency, Gerald Ford succeeded him as president. As his chief of staff, he chose Donald Rumsfeld. And as his deputy chief of staff, he chose none other than Dick Cheney himself. Rumsfeld and Cheney became a powerful duo in the Ford White House, fiercely protective of the president. Cheney had a mature nature about him that earned him a lot of respect. In 75, Ford decided to shake up his administration, which Rumsfeld and Cheney were heavily behind, and Rumsfeld becomes the Secretary of Defense while Cheney steps into the role of Chief of Staff, making him the youngest ever at 34. Once Ford was defeated by Jimmy Carter in the 1976 election, Cheney had to set his sights on something else. He decided to run for the House of Representatives in Wyoming. But during the campaign, he suffers his first heart attack at the young age of 37. Despite this, he pulls out a win. As a congressman, Cheney solidified his conservative nature with his views on gun control and abortion. The people of Wyoming would go on to re-elect him 5 times to the office. During this period, Cheney would have his second heart attack, and in 1988, he had his third, which resulted in a quadruple bypass surgery. It was clear at this point that Cheney had a severely bad heart. In 1989, Cheney was summoned by the President, George H.W. Bush, to be the Secretary of Defense. He was confirmed unanimously by the Senate on a 92-0 vote. As Secretary of Defense, Cheney met with Bush regularly. He appointed General Colin Powell as the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, making him the youngest and first black man to hold the position. Cheney would serve in the department during important events like the Soviet collapse and Operation Desert Storm. His time would come to an end with the election of Bill Clinton. But Cheney had a new goal in mind, and it was becoming the President of the United States. He decided to drive around the country and see about possibly having a presidential campaign of his own. But after only polling at 3%, Cheney realized he needed to drop the dream. Instead, he joins the private sector and becomes the CEO of Halliburton, one of the world's largest oil service companies, and he's making bank. While still working for the company, Cheney was approached by Governor George W. Bush, who was running in 2000 for the presidency, asking Cheney to be his running mate, in which he declined. Bush then asked Cheney if he would find him a running mate, to which he said yeah. Cheney scouted potential contenders, doing an extremely thorough investigation on each subject, gathering things like medical records, tax returns, and past doings. Cheney admitted he himself probably wouldn't have given such information up that he was asking for from others. Upon meeting with Bush to discuss potential candidates, it seemed as if none of them were fitting the mold. Eventually, Bush once again offers Cheney the position, and only this time, Cheney accepts. Perhaps what appealed most to Bush was Cheney's extensive understanding of Washington. It surely wasn't for Wyoming's 3 electoral votes. Cheney was a powerhouse who had connections and was sure of himself. He was the experience George Bush needed, or so George Bush initially thought. Eventually, it would come full circle for the president. The man who he thought he needed most would get them in the hottest water. By 2008, their relationship was one of pure convenience. Vice President John Nance Garner once described the job as not worth a bucket of warm spit. However, if you were to ask Dick Cheney, I think you would have gotten a different answer. Cheney completely redefined the role of the vice presidency, barreling through any critics he had. Many believe he had uncontrolled power. I mean, Cheney himself said that he had full rein to attend any meeting and get involved in absolutely anything. While the 2000 election was dragging on with no winner, Cheney was quietly assembling the transition team and administration in case they happened to be elected. From the start, he made known, with the backing of the president, just how strong his presence would be. In the beginning, their approval rating was good and the new administration seemed well-liked, but on that 9th month, everything would change. While Bush was in Florida reading to a classroom of children, it was business as usual for Cheney. He had received word that a plane had hit the World Trade Center, a horrible and tragic mistake. In his office, Cheney puts on the TV to watch the news coverage. He then watches as it happens. The second plane hits. Before he can even realize, Cheney is taken by the back of his belt and pulled away by Secret Service. He is immediately taken to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, or the PEOC, which is a bunker under the East Wing, and as far as we are aware, it is still there today. The president is airborne and unable to communicate properly and securely, leaving Dick Cheney as the man in charge in Washington. Lynn, Dick's wife, and First Lady Barbara Bush are brought down to the PEOC as well. According to people in the room with him that day, Cheney was exceptionally calm and collected. He took control of the situation, ordering the military to shoot down any aircraft still in the sky that looked threatening. This decision has been viewed as risky and controversial due to the fact that a plane full of innocent civilians could have been misidentified and shot down. False reports of threats to Air Force One, bombings, and other planes down began being reported to Cheney. Throughout the chaos, everyone turned to the vice president and his leadership. Eventually, President Bush was able to return to Washington, D.C. Marine Two, the vice president's helicopter, landed on the south lawn of the White House and took Dick and Lynn to an undisclosed location, which we know now to have been Camp David. 5 days after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, Cheney went on Meet the Press to discuss the attacks. During the interview, Cheney said that he had no doubt that Osama bin Laden and his organization had a role in 9/11. He also infamously said that the United States will have to work in the dark side. The war on terror became the main objective from there on out. By October 2001, we were at war with Afghanistan. The Secretary of Defense under George W. Bush was none other than Donald Rumsfeld. A detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, would be used by the U.S. military for terrorists. Here, methods used on prisoners would be questioned. Actually, let me just have Cheney describe it in his own words.
Isolation in the cell, or loud music. A face slap was allowed. It had to be open-handed. You could push them up against a wall. There were certain things like that. Putting the individual on an incline, their head down lower than their feet, putting a towel over their face, and then pouring water slowly on the towel. It creates a sensation of drowning.
After severe backlash, Cheney defended the action, saying he would do it all again in a minute. While giving a speech in 2002, Cheney said, simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. By 2003, we were at war with Iraq to find those WMDs. But there was one slight problem. There actually wasn't any WMDs to begin with. The nation began to lose faith in the Bush administration. Many felt as if Dick Cheney was the one calling the shots and that we had gotten into a pointless war. 2004 was an election year, and George Bush began showing his disdain towards Dick Cheney and his ill advice. Cheney knew his boss wasn't very happy, so he offered 3 different times to drop himself from the re-election ticket. Bush declined and kept him on. They would be re-elected, but Cheney soon realized he wouldn't be in the loop. He became more of an irrelevant player in the administration. Bush felt embarrassed and humiliated by his VP due to all the inaccurate information. He simply wasn't able to take Cheney's word at face value anymore. Someone had to take a hit for the unpopular Iraq war, and it wasn't going to be Bush or Cheney. But you know who it would be? Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The guy who brought Cheney up was possibly taken out from Cheney's own doing. For as much as Cheney was trying to lay low during the second term, he just simply couldn't help but get attention. While quail hunting in Texas, Cheney accidentally shot Harry Whittington, a prominent Texas lawyer. Whittington was in the hospital for about a week after the incident, and when he got out, he actually goes on to apologize to Cheney and his family for all they've had to go through. Damn, what kind of hold did Dick Cheney have on people? Once Obama became president in 2009, Cheney retired with a controversial reputation that would only grow throughout the years. Dealings with Halliburton and the revenue that they made from the war has people questioning Cheney's business and political practices. His stone-cold, unapologetic tone never helped his case. A 2013 documentary called The World According to Dick Cheney premiered. He was asked what his main fault was, where Cheney answered, "Well, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about my faults, I guess." He and Lynn would have 2 daughters, Liz and Mary. Liz Cheney would follow in her father's footsteps and become a politician. Donald Trump has actually mocked her, saying she should be put in front of a firing squad. This, for one reason, is why Dick Cheney shockingly endorsed Kamala Harris for the 2024 presidential election. Many wondered why Harris would even admit his endorsement or even want it to begin with. Perhaps it did her more harm than good. It's really hard to find a Democrat who is a Cheney supporter. On November 3rd of this year, Dick Cheney passed away at the age of 84. He died from complications of pneumonia and cardiac and vascular disease. His wife and daughters were there with him when he passed. George W. Bush released a statement. "Laura and I will remember Dick Cheney for the decent, honorable man that he was. History will remember him as among the finest public servants of his generation." Barack Obama, Kamala Harris, and Joe Biden are among many of the Democrats who have also sent thoughts and prayers to the Cheney family. Donald Trump, however, has yet to publicly acknowledge Cheney's death. But in the end, Donald Trump really did more for Cheney than he even realizes. He made Cheney no longer the most hated politician of the 21st century. He's taken that title away and ran with it. If you like this episode over Dick Cheney, leave the show a rating or review wherever you listen. If you have any questions or comments about the show or any episode suggestions, email me at thechroniclesoftimepodcast@gmail.com. That's thechroniclesoftimepodcast@gmail.com. All my citations for the episode can be found on my website at thechroniclesoftimepodcast.com. To stay up to date with all stuff TCOT, follow my Instagram and Facebook page. Thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, Rachel Payton, and this has been the Chronicles of Time.